Hello, my name is Colin Daniels. I'm the Working Age and Young People Service Manager for the Macular Society. Now, as you might know, the Macular Society hosts two live webinars each month focusing on all aspects of living with macular disease. We speak to leading experts, clinicians, and researchers about the latest in macular disease. The first of the webinars focuses very much on age-related macular degeneration, and the second on areas for people of a working age and a bit younger. Now, we understand that not everyone has the opportunity to watch our webinars, so we have decided to turn some of the content into podcasts. The podcasts will be available on all good podcast platforms. So here we go. Welcome to this one on BEST's. We've got Amanda Carr, Dr. Amanda Carr from UCL, to talk about her work and research into BEST's. We've also got Geraldine Hoad, who's the research manager from the Macular Society.
Hello, everybody.
Jerry will be having a little bit of a chat right at the end about the sort of work that we do with around research and bits. Is that okay, Jerry?
Yep, absolutely fine. Thank you. And I'll help out with the questions.
Perfect. Yes, brilliant. So without further ado, because you don't need to hear me waffling on, you can talk to me anytime by giving me a call. So we're here to listen to Amanda's talk. So we've got Amanda Carr this evening, Dr. Amanda Carr. She's going to talk about BEST's, and I can never say the next word without chipping over my own teeth, so I'm not even going to pop that, about her research into BEST disease and genetics and things like that around that and stem cells and bits and pieces. She works at the Institute of Ophthalmology for UCL, and she's a good friend of the Macular Society, and we're very pleased to have her this evening. So, Amanda, welcome.
Hi, everybody. Thanks, Colin. Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me to talk here tonight, Colin. I hope that you're all well. So the goal of the clinic, from my point of view, is to talk about the research that we've been doing here at the Institute of Ophthalmology. And when Colin asked me for a talk, I couldn't help but think of the start of The Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times, the worst of times, an age of wisdom and an age of fooliness, which I think pretty aptly sums up the last year and everything that's been going on. And it also refers loosely to the gene that we're interested in, which is the BEST1 gene. I'm going to give a quick introduction to the macula and to retinal pigment epithelial cells, which is the cells that are affected in the diseases that we're interested in, and how we're using stem cells to investigate these diseases. So I'm going to be concentrating on bestrophinopathies and how we're using stem cells to investigate disease and also to develop treatments for the disease. And I'm going to be focusing specifically on looking at the new sort of genome therapies that are being developed. That's gene therapy and gene editing. And I'll also talk to you briefly about what we've been up to during COVID when we've been unable to work in the research labs. So I've been working on macular disease for the last 15 years and initially started working with age-related macular degeneration. And that's a more common form of macular disease that generally affects the elderly population. And this causes the loss of vision in the central area of the retina in a region called the macula. And similar to inherited maculopathies, the area that's affected has a high concentration of cone photoreceptors. And these are the cells that we need to see the fine details, for example, when we're reading, driving or watching. So it's that fine acuity central vision that's affected in the diseases that I'm interested in. So the macular region is quite a complex region, and up until recently, opticians and ophthalmologists were only really able to view the back of the eye and see the retina as part of the macula. And this is the tissue that we see quite clearly as red eye when we're taking photographs with a flash camera. It comes up as red. Now, the retina is the tissue that detects light, and this enables us to see. But underneath the retina, there's a lot of things going on that you don't necessarily see when you're looking right at the back of the eye. So underneath the retina, there's a layer of cells called the retinal pigment epithelium, or RPE. And underneath this, there's a vast blood network. And there's a close interaction between the retina and the RPE, and the RPE and the choroid. And these interactions are necessary to make sure that the retina itself stays healthy. Now, the cells that I'm interested in are the retinal pigment epithelium, or the RPE. And this is a single layer of cells that separates the photoreceptors in the retina from the blood supply. And the RPE are needed to keep the retina healthy and create an environment that allows the photoreceptors to detect light. So the RPE has a number of roles that help to keep those photoreceptors alive and healthy. So the RPE are involved in transporting nutrients and ions and everything that's needed to keep a photoreceptor healthy and doing its job. And they also take away the rubbish, the debris, excess water, and things like that, and send that back through the blood once it's been processed. The RPE also needed to recycle substances from the retina. So to detect light, the photoreceptor cells need a protein, and that protein changes once light's detected. So that used up protein then gets sent to the RPE cells, and then it goes through a process of recycling and then goes back to the photoreceptor cells. So that's another way that the RPE help us detect light. And they also absorb stray light. So obviously light's focused to the back of the eye, and sometimes that can sort of miss the photoreceptors. So we need a sort of very finely focused light to be able to detect things properly. So the RPE plays a key role in absorbing that stray light. And importantly, the RPE forms a barrier. So it stops things just passing between the blood supply and the photoreceptor cells. So it acts as kind of a gateway between the retina and the choroid. Blood supply. So what happens in diseases? Well, the RPE don't function correctly. And when this happens, this can cause loss of photoreceptor cells and therefore vision loss. And you can get this through a variety of processes. It can occur when the debris from the photoreceptor cells start building up in the RPE, and this causes them not to work as efficiently. It can also cause a physical barrier between either the RPE and the choroid blood supply, or between the photoreceptors themselves, and stops the RPE doing their job. And over time, the RPE cells are exposed to a variety of stresses. So, you know, they're detecting light every day, they use up a lot of energy, they produce a lot of waste. And over time, the cells just don't work as well as they do. And again, that can cause photoreceptor cell loss. And other properties like the barrier properties, once the cells start degenerating, that barrier stops working as effectively. And what this can lead to is infiltration of new blood vessels from the blood supply into the retina. And these are often quite weak vessels, and they can lead to bleeds in the retina. And then this again can cause loss of vision in patients. So the RPE and the photoreceptor cells are specialised cells that perform specific functions. The photoreceptor cells detect light, and they convert the signal into an electrical stimulus. And the retinal neurons above the photoreceptors act like a cable, and they take this electrical information to the brain, where the signals are then interpreted. And the cells at the back of our eye are there from our birth and until we die, basically. They last us all our lives, and they're never renewed. And so when the macular area is exposed to these sort of daily stresses of light, energy use, it makes it vulnerable to degeneration over our lifetimes. And cells like the retinal pigment epithelium can become worn with age or because of genetic issues. And unlike other regions of the body where cells can be renewed and replaced, that doesn't happen at the back of the eye. So the RPE cells are there to keep our photoreceptors healthy. If they die or don't do their job correctly, the photoreceptors and the retinal neurons can be lost, causing irreversible vision loss. So as I mentioned, I've been working on macular diseases for a while, and it all started in 2006, working with Pete Coffey and Linda De Cruz on the London Project to Cure Blindness. And the aim of this project was to make new retinal pigment epithelial cells for patients with age-related macular degeneration. And these were going to be used to sort of replace the cells that are degenerated in the patients. And one of the first parts of the project is to come up with cells that we could use to replace the degenerating RPE. And we started working with Peter Andrews at the University of Sheffield to develop a human embryonic stem cell therapy for age-related macular degeneration. So in the embryo, there's a population of cells that go on to make every single cell in your body. And Peter Andrews was able to take cells and culture these cells and grow them. And in a dish, those cells are capable of making every cell in your body. And we developed protocols and methods to drive these stem cells to become retinal pigment epithelial cells, which we could then use as a replacement. So this project was developed into a clinical trial, which has so far successfully treated 2 patients with AMD. But it was during this time in the lab that a new sort of technology emerged called cellular reprogramming. And this has completely changed the way that we look at human diseases now. So cellular reprogramming itself is a way of turning back time in cells. So we can take an adult cell and turn it into a stem cell, essentially. So for us to do this, we do it with patients, and we take a skin biopsy or a blood sample. And in this instance here, we take the biopsy, we put it in a dish, and we leave it in the dish. And then after a couple of weeks, you get skin cells growing out from the biopsy, and these cells stick to the tissue culture dish. And we can then use those skin cells and reprogram them into stem cells. And we call these induced pluripotent stem cells because we induce the stem cell-ness of them. And similar to human embryonic stem cells, these cells are capable of turning into every cell in the body. Now, we're interested in the RPE, so obviously we want to turn them into RPE cells. So this is what we can do. We use the same differentiation protocols for the human embryonic stem cells as we do for the induced pluripotent stem cells, and turn them into RPE cells in a dish. Now, these patient-derived cells are important for iSearch for 2 reasons, really. So the RPE cells we create from a patient contain the same genetic information that the patient has. So when we grow these new cells in a dish, the genes of the patient are also found in the cells. And so we can look to see how genes affect the cell behavior, and particularly how mutations affect the behavior of cells. And so we can start to understand what has happened in the cells to cause vision loss. So it's a platform to understand diseases. And secondly, these cells are important because they come from patients with a genetic mutation. We can use these cells to develop and test new therapies for treating sight loss, particularly those that are caused by mutations. So we've created a stem cell bank that contains cells from a variety of patients with inherited retinal dystrophies. And my lab focuses on diseases that primarily affect the retinal pigment epithelium. So today I'm going to talk about bestrophinopathies, and these are a group of inherited diseases that affects the RPE cells at the back of the eye. So this includes Best disease and adult onset patelliform macular degeneration, autosomal recessive bestrophinopathy, which is known as ARB, autosomal dominant vitreoretinoid choroidopathy, which is known as ADVERC, and also there's forms of bestrophinopathies that are classed as retinitis pigmentosa. And you can see that these diseases are quite distinct, just looking at the back of the eye. So with Best disease, you get this classic egg yolk type lesion, this yellow lesion in the macular region. With ARB, it's very similar to AMD, where you get multiple deposits of this fatty product at the back of the eye. With ADVERC, you get this increased pigmentation in the periphery of the retina, which then sort of encroaches on the macular region, and then you then get vision loss. And then with RP, the retinitis pigmentosa form, it's a sort of classical RP phenotype where you get increased pigmentation and these kind of bone spicules and fatty deposits in the macular region. So if these diseases are so different, why are they classed together as bestrophinopathies? Well, that's because these diseases are caused by a single mutations in a single gene, called bestrophin-1 or BEST1. Now, the BEST1 gene is a region of our DNA that contains the instructions to make the BEST1 protein. And then the cell machinery responsible for making that protein reads those genetic instructions and interprets that to make the protein. So the BEST protein is only made in the RPE cells of the eye. And in these cells, it forms a channel along the base of the cells and up the side of the cells. And its role in the RPE is to regulate the movement of chloride molecules in and out of the cell. So a change in the best gene DNA sequence can change the instructions to make the protein. And this can lead to changes in the way the protein works, which can have a big impact on the RP cells that we're looking at. So there are a number of ways that mutations in the gene sequence can affect the protein. So as I said, best channels are normally found on the bottom and along the sides of cells. And in some patients, they have mutations where they make the channel, it goes to the right place, but it just doesn't work. In some patients, they make the protein, it's localized where it should be, but it's also localized elsewhere and is expressed in the wrong place. And this can affect the way that the cell works. In some mutations, you get no bestrophin protein formed, and that has a big impact on cells. And in others, you have bestrophin protein that's not localized correctly in the right position and is degraded by the cell. So it's not functional at all. And so these changes in the function and the location of the bestrophin channel can affect the sort of the fine balance of the processes going on within the RP cell. And over a period of time, it can cause the cells to become unhealthy and even to die, leading to loss of those photoreceptor cells that the RP are looking after. So we're using induced pluripotent stem cells from patients to help us find out what's going wrong in their own eye cells, which means that we can identify these early gene pathways and potentially develop new therapies. Now, one of the biggest challenges we face with inherited diseases is that it lies within mutations within the eye. And the eye has become a really important organ now for developing therapeutic strategies that target DNA itself. And it's the aim now is to sort of change the genes within our cells so that it changes the way that proteins are made. And from a scientific point of view, this is the eye is the perfect organ in which to do these type and develop these type of therapies because, you know, the eye is easily accessible. We have a window through our eye where we can see back to the retina. The eye is pretty isolated from other areas of the body, so we can inject therapies directly into the eye. The macular region is a very small region, so we only need to administer small amounts of treatments. And the eye has an immune privilege, which means it's able to tolerate the introduction of these therapies without developing the immune reaction you might see elsewhere in the body. Obviously, we have two eyes, which means that we can test whether a therapy is safe and whether it works by treating one eye and then comparing what's happening in that eye to the non-treated eye. And obviously, you know, we have lots of ways that we can look at the eye and look in with medical imaging equipment. We can look at the back of the retina. We can now look at the individual layers at the back of the eye to see whether the treatments are working properly and keeping the cells that we're trying to keep alive. And we can also use very simple eye tests to see whether these treatments are having a functional impact in patients, whether it's allowing them to see better. So there's all these properties of the eye that make it an ideal organ to develop these treatments. So it kind of came as no surprise that the new sort of therapies were being tested in these particular organs. And the first NICE approved gene therapy was for an inherited eye disease. So I'm just going to talk to you briefly about these potential therapies. What is gene therapy and what does it do? Well, gene therapy is a treatment that provides a new super working copy of a gene that's not made properly in the patient's cells. And the cell can use genetic instructions, which are provided by a virus. So the virus infects the cells and delivers a set of new gene instructions into those cells. And the cell can then use those new gene instructions to then make the protein. And this new protein can then restore the normal function of the cells. So we use viruses similar to like the common cold, and we can genetically modify them in the lab so that we take out all the genes that the virus needs to reproduce and make its own genes. And we can replace that with the gene that we're interested in and the gene that we want a human cell to make. And so gene therapy is now available in the clinic for a form of blindness called Leber's congenital amaurosis. And this is an inherited form of blindness that's caused in some patients by mutations in the RPE65 gene. So this particular disease isn't suitable for all patients with Leber's congenital amaurosis because there's up to 18 genes now that have now been identified that can lead to a labus congenitum amaurosis. So it's for a specific subset of patients with a particular type of mutation. And gene therapy is also in clinical trials for macular disease, in particular age-related macular degeneration. So a recent trial has started in the UK, looking at replacing complement factor I, which is one of the genes that are involved in AMD. And it seems to be showing promising results at the moment. But there are also gene therapies and developments in the research labs at the moment for bestrophinopathies. An example of this is a group in the US that's shown that a bestrophin gene therapy can be used to treat a canine version of bestrophinopathy. So again, that's showing promising results that will hopefully translate into more clinical work in patients. But in the last decade, there's a new model of genome editing that's sort of rapidly transformed therapies for genetic diseases. So unlike gene therapy, which is used to add healthy copies of the gene into cells, genome editing gets right to the heart of the problem, which is fixing that disease-causing mutation in the patient's own DNA. And the principle behind genome editing involves making a precise cut in the DNA near to the mutation site in the affected gene, and then getting the cell and the cell's own repair mechanisms to fix the gene. And it's during this time where the cell's repairing the gene that we can modify those changes to change that DNA sequence in the patient's own cells. So how does it work? Well, the first step in gene editing is to create a cut in the DNA. And to do this, we use an enzyme called Cas9. And the whole system itself, you may have heard of it, is called CRISPR-Cas9. And it consists of an enzyme which can cut the DNA and a guide sequence. And this guide sequence basically tells the enzyme where to go and where to cut. So in the lab, we can create these guides and tell the enzyme precisely where to cut and make a double-stranded cut in a patient's DNA. We then rely on the cell's own repair mechanisms to fix the DNA. And it's during this point that we can introduce those changes into the DNA. So once we've cut the DNA with the CRISPR-Cas9, we can take two approaches. We can directly repair those mutated genes. And to do this, I liken it to plumbing, where, you know, you've got a hole in one of the pipes. You can cut out that region of the pipe and replace it with a new region and weld it back together. And that's essentially what the cell is doing during directed repair of mutated genes. So we make the cut into the DNA. We then provide a healthy template DNA, which is used to replace the region that we're cutting out. And then the cell, when it's repairing the DNA, incorporates that healthy DNA into the patient's own sequence and repairs the DNA that way. Now, this is a really nice way of doing things, but unfortunately, it's not that efficient in cells, in particular in cells like the RPE that aren't dividing. So there's other ways that we can fix the DNA. We can do a thing called end joining. And again, this involves breaking the DNA in a precise place using the CRISPR-Cas9. But then we use the cell's own repair mechanisms to fix those ends back together. The thing about this way of fixing DNA is it's not that efficient, and it can lead to bits of DNA being added to the sequence or bits of DNA being taken away. And what this does is it kind of changes the meaning of the DNA. And instead of making a DNA sequence that gives the instructions for the protein, it kind of makes a DNA that's turned into complete nonsense. And that makes either an incomplete or a non-functional protein, or the protein doesn't get made at all. So this is a really nice, efficient way of switching off a mutated gene in cells. But because this addition or deletion of bits of DNA isn't too reproducible, we never know what sort of combination of nonsense DNA we'll get. So it can be quite problematic. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to switch off the faulty gene with CRISPR, but using a little bit of a different approach. What we're doing is we're looking for small differences in the bestrophin genes. So for patients with dominant disease, they have a healthy copy of the gene that is able to do its normal role in cells, and they also have a faulty copy of the gene which contains the mutation. So what we're trying to do is to switch off this faulty copy of the gene. And we're doing this by looking for small changes in the DNA sequence of the faulty gene that we can use to target CRISPR to cut within that region. So in our DNA, we have lots of changes that, you know, make, we inherit one copy of our gene from our mother, one from our father. And those DNA sequences have lots of little variations in them. And those variations don't necessarily cause diseases, but they're there and present anyway. So we can use these small changes in DNA to target CRISPR to cut the faulty gene only. And this is what we have here. We've got two variations in the DNA sequence. We can target that, the CRISPR to cut that. It removes a large portion of the gene. The cell machinery then fits it back together. And we've essentially inactivated the gene. So we think that by switching off the faulty copy of the gene, we can leave the normal copy of the gene to be able to do its normal job and produce a bestrophin protein that works. So I'm just going to give you a quick overview of how we've been doing this in patient cells. So this is one patient that we've been working with, and this patient has Best disease, and it's quite progressed disease. So the patient has gone through the disease, they've gone through the yolk, egg yolk stage, and they've gone to what we call the sort of the scrambled egg stage, which is more late stage where the cells in the retina start dying. And you can see this black spot at the back of the eye where cells have actually been lost. And looking at OCT, you can see there's a big disruption in the layers of the retina. There's fluid underneath the lesion site, and this patient has significant central vision loss. So the patient got in touch with us and we had a good chat, and they wanted to get involved in the research. And so we took a skin biopsy from the patient, grew the skin cells from the patient, and then reprogrammed those skin cells into stem cells. And again, these stem cells are capable of making any cell in the body, but we're interested in the RPE. So we use our methods to drive these stem cells to become retinal pigment epithelial cells. So this is that patient's RPE cells in a dish. And these RPE contain the same mutation that the patient has. So just looking at the effect of the mutation in the cells. So this particular patient has a mutation which, if you've had your mutation sequence, you might get this sort of information back where it's described as a C37, C to T, PR13C. Now, you know, looking at this, it's not very clear what this means, but essentially this is information that's come back from a hospital and a sequencing lab telling us that within the DNA sequence of the bestrophin gene, there's a change in the DNA sequence at position 37. And instead of having a letter C, this has been changed to a letter T. So you can see this here. But what this means for the protein is described later on. So this PR13C means there's been a change in the protein at the amino acid sequence 13. And in this case, the amino acid, which was an arginine under normal conditions, has been mutated and now contains a cysteine. So this is an amino acid change caused by the DNA change. Now, in normal patients, healthy patients, we have a nice RPE monolayer with pigmented cells. The cells are quite high, and you can see the blue nucleus at the bottom of the cells. And we can stain to see where bestrophin protein is made. We can see at the top of the cells, this is just a marker that labels the top of cells, and the bestrophin protein is produced along the sides of the cells and along the bottom of the cells. Now, this particular mutation in the patient caused some big changes to the cells. So instead of getting those nice, tall epithelial cells, what we see is these sort of squished, flattened RPE cells. So it's changed the sort of the integrity of the cell itself. And when we look at bestrophin expression to see what's happening in the cells, with the apical marker here, we can see that bestrophin isn't localized where it should be. And in this particular case, it's expressed throughout the cells. So it's obviously not doing the job that it should be doing in the patient. So we've been using this patient's cells to investigate inactivating the bestrophin gene. So we've sequenced the healthy copy of the bestrophin gene and also the mutated copy. And we've identified those small variants and found unique ones that are only present on the mutated allele. And what we've done is we've designed a CRISPR technology to cut these particular sites that are only present on the mutated gene. We've then treated the cells with the guides and the CRISPR-Cas9, isolated these iPS cells that are now gene edited. So the mutated copy has been switched off. And then we've been using these cells to make new RPE that we can then go on to see what happens when we switch off this mutated copy. So this was how far we were with research. And then we went into lockdown. We were told that we had to stop all our work and essentially freeze down all our cells. And the labs were closed for, it was almost 5 months. And we weren't able to do any research. The only thing that I was able to do as part of the job is to go in and fill up the liquid nitrogen tanks every 2 weeks. And these are the tanks that we keep all our cells in. So we you know, that was one thing that we had to make sure was still ongoing, that we had cells that we could come back to. So we were sort of faced with a situation where we weren't able to go into the lab. And what do you do under those circumstances? And you know, how do we do our work? And particularly it was very testing for some of our PhD students and master students who are in the lab to do a project. So we had two students in the lab last year. So Sim Grewal, who is a master student, and Joe Smith, the PhD student. And both of their research studies were interrupted by COVID lockdown. So we had a sit down and we had a chat about what we could do and how we could, you know, develop a project for Sim that wasn't lab-based. So we decided what would be a good thing was try to produce a resource page for bestrophinopathies. And this is what Sim's MSc project, which was originally a lab project, turned into. And I think he did a pretty amazing job. He came up with a questionnaire, which we sent to patients, asking them, you know, what type of devices they used, how we could tailor this specifically to them, and what type of things they were interested in, what they wanted to know about, and all sorts of really useful information. The questionnaire came back and Sim put together this website, which I think was pretty outstanding with the help of Joe to get it up online. And this website basically contains a lot of information, more in-depth information about what I've been talking about tonight. So there's information about the bestrophinopathies, the eye, the genetic. So we have a page dedicated to sort of each individual bestrophinopathy, looking at how it develops, the complications that the disease has. We look at how bestrophinopathies are diagnosed, so the different tests that are used, the sequencing, the electrical testing that can be used to diagnose bestrophinopathies. We've got histories about the back of the eye, how it works, how the RPE and the photoreceptor cells work, and the genetics of the disease, you know, what causes the bestrophinopathies, how they're inherited, sort of the dominant forms, the recessive forms, the spontaneous forms. And there's also pages about the research. So we've got pages about the research into the disease that's ongoing in our lab and in other labs, and similarly research into the newly sort of developing genetic therapies. So there's sort of overview of the work going on in the US and the UK. And we also held a patient, Best Disease Patient Day in 2018. And during that time, we had a lot of really good speakers from the Institute who gave talks. So we've also put those videos up online. So that can be found on the Best Disease Patient Day. And we've also got an area for supporting patients and families with bestrophinopathies. So there's lots of information about various support groups, like for the young persons group that meets in London a couple of times a year, the Macular Society, the Young Persons Working Group. There's resources to link to Facebook groups interested in best disease. So those are all up online, and I would encourage you, you know, if there's further information, please, you know, use this website. We've got a shortened form of the research page. It's bit.ly /best resource. And that can be used to access the page. And otherwise, you know, if there's any other information that you want to get, you can always contact me. And so this work wouldn't have been possible without quite a few members of the lab over the last couple of years. So we've had Britton Amister, who was a PhD student with me, who's now working producing GMP cells ready to go into patients. And then PhD students Will Letton and Joe Smith, who've worked on bestrophinopathies, and also Sim, who's been the main driver behind the bestrophinopathies resource page. So with that, that's the end of my talk. And if you have any questions, I'd be very happy to answer them.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. That's really very interesting. First time I've heard a virus talked about recently that everyone's happy to hear about, I would think. Jerry, I'm assuming we've had plenty of things come through. So do you want to ask Amanda a few questions?
Okay. The first one is, are the new therapies designed to restore damaged sight, or only able to prevent further sight loss?
So these therapies themselves, if a patient's already suffered sight loss, these therapies won't be able to treat that. But the overall aim is to get these therapies into patients before they lose their sight. So it could be used as a preventative treatment. So if you have an inherited disease and you know your parents have it and you're checked for it, there could be the possibility of having these treatments before you suffer any vision loss. Gustav Aguero, he's been doing the work in the dogs who have a dog form of bestrophinopathy, and he's been using gene therapy to treat these dogs. And he's got some really interesting results, and very surprising that, you know, it can fix basically the RPE cells. So it's not likely to affect the photoreceptor cells if they've already been lost, but you can restore the RPE and make them work again. So
thank you. Would you say something about the importance of a genetic diagnosis for somebody with BEST disease, particularly in relation to the new therapies that are coming through?
Yeah, so for the BEST diagnosis, because you've got these different forms of the disease, sometimes it can be difficult to diagnose a patient with either BEST disease, AMD, you know, when it comes to the ARB form where it looks like AMD, and the retinitis pigmentosa form, which can be caused by a lot of other genes. It's very important to have a diagnosis in terms of what the sequencing mutation is, particularly for these gene therapies, because you want to know what gene is mutated before you can treat it. And so it's very important, and particularly, you know, with the patient that I showed there, we target a specific region of that gene, and we have to sequence that gene to be able to develop a treatment. So, yeah, I definitely encourage patients to talk to their ophthalmologists about, you know, if they have a diagnosis of BEST disease, knowing that sequence could help in the future.
Thank you. I have BEST disease and I have two young children. When would we begin monitoring them? I presume she means monitoring their eyesight for changes due to BEST disease?
Yeah. So this is the thing with bestrophinopathies. They can affect even the same family members very differently. So if you have an adult onset, that doesn't mean that, you know, children will have that adult onset. It can come on earlier in children. So I think it's, you know, if you have a history of it in your family, it's important to keep an eye on your children from an early age. You know, I've known patients that are diagnosed from 2 years of age. So it can occur very early, some children, or it can come on adult onset. So, and there's no really way of knowing how it's going to affect somebody. Somebody can have a mutation, but they don't have any sight loss, and they manage to live, you know, with a mutation. They're known as sort of carriers of the mutation because it's not affected their sight loss, whereas they can have a child where they do have sort of serious effects from those mutations. So it is very important to keep an eye on children if you have a family history.
Thank you. When is this potential treatment potentially going to be readily available to the public? It's the inevitable question.
Yeah.
How long do you have to wait for a treatment?
Yeah. Well, it's not going to be available immediately with gene therapy. So for the Luxturna genome therapy, the gene therapy treatments, work on that started about 20 years ago. And it's taken quite a number of years to get to a phase where it's approved by NICE. Obviously, there was the clinical trials going on in the meantime, but to get clinical approval, it does take a long time. So you're looking at least sort of 10 years minimum, and could be more. But, you know, it's encouraging that there's already been a gene editing trial that's gone on in a patient with Leber's congenital amaurosis. So they've been treated with that CRISPR-Cas9 therapy, and it's the first time it's been used in a patient. So again, the eye's kind of at the forefront of these treatments and developing these treatments. So it's more likely that these treatments are going to be available in the eye first before any of those treatments are available for any other part of the body. So yes, it's encouraging.
Which is good news. It's good news, yes.
Yeah.
Can we stop the disease getting any worse? Can we stop the vision loss in any way? At the moment,
no, there are no current treatments for bestrophinopathies. There are treatments for the kind of complications of bestrophinopathies. So things like the neovascularization, which is where the blood vessels grow into the retina and cause bleeds. So that's something that happens in bestrophinopathies. So that can be treated, but the actual disease itself and what's happening in the RP itself can't be treated at the moment.
Thank you. Is it possible to create new photoreceptor cells? I think it is. There's people working on that, aren't there?
Yes. So there are lots of groups working on that. We worked on the RPE for, you know, 10 years ago. We were making RPE, and it's very easy to make RPE because they're a single layer of cells. Photoreceptors are a little bit more complicated. Making them in a culture dish takes a lot longer. So you're looking at least 9 months of growing a cell in a dish to make it become a photoreceptor. The other difficult thing is because it's involved in that electrical signal, there's a very complex neural circuitry that would have to be re-established. So there's a lot of work ongoing at the moment, but because it's more complicated than making an RPE cell, it's going to take a lot longer before we can do anything like photoreceptor cell transplantations.
I'll just mention we have a project with somebody else at UCL, Jane Sowden.
Yeah.
And she's investigating exactly that, trying to improve the chances of the photoreceptors transplanting efficiently. So making them connections between the photoreceptors and the neurons.
It's definitely more complicated.
Yeah, and that would be applied for any disease, I imagine.
Yeah.
What could I do myself to help prevent or slow any deterioration? Is there anything people can do?
Well, there's been no specific research, as far as I know, into sort of best disease, but, you know, there are things you can do to look after your eye health in general. So, you know, being a healthy weight, exercise, diet, particularly sort of the green leafy vegetables that contain the antioxidants, fresh fruit and vegetables, those have been linked to sort of lower levels of oxidative stress, which isn't good for the RPE cells. So that helps as well. Obviously, smoking's known to accelerate macular disease. So if you smoke, stop smoking. And also, you know, protect your eyes. So if you go outside, you know, maybe wear the sunglasses and the hats to protect your eyes from that, you know, extra light exposure. But again, those are just general things that, you know, can help your eye health rather than being specific to bestrophinopathies.
Thank you.
Brilliant. Thanks ever so much, Amanda. That's really interesting. I really like listening to you talk. I've heard you do it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Conferences and things. So it's we always learn something new. It's really fantastic. So anyway, thank you very much. It's really interesting. Jerry, do you want to just have a few minutes talking about what we're up to?
Yes, absolutely. So the Macular Society, in case you aren't aware, has a programme of research on all types of macular disease. So we've got Amanda working on BEST, we've got other people working on Stargardt disease and Doyne honeycomb dystrophy. We're going to be continuing to grow our research programme, but we also are very involved in involving patients in research, and we know patients want to get involved in research in all sorts of ways. So I will just mention that we have a database, we call it our research participant database, that people can apply to. It's a feature on the website in the research section. We just ask for some basic details about you and about your condition. And then if a clinical trial is looking for patients and we're asked to help you to recruit for it, we can contact you and let you know about it. We don't provide your information to anybody. We're just a kind of a matchmaking service between the researchers looking for patients to take part in a clinical trial and patients wanting to hear about it. So we send you information and then it's up to you whether you volunteer or not. So I would encourage people to sign up to that. I mean, we don't have any clinical trials on BEST at the moment, but, you know, in a few years' time, every possibility that we might do. And we also keep an eye on our website. We always research news. We're always featuring important breakthroughs as they come through. So do keep an eye on that. So really, it's just our research program is very important to us, as well as our support for people with macular disease. And Amanda's one of our stars. And we've got a lot of research going on, and we talk about it a lot on our website. And in our SciView magazine, if you're a member, because eye research, although it's underfunded, certainly in the UK it is, there is actually a massive amount going on. Part of my job is keeping up with all the research that's going on all around the world, and I'm having trouble keeping up at the moment. There's a lot going on.
That's really good news. It always amazes me how much research is going on around the world. And really pleased if you do want to get involved in any research, please just join our participants. Well, that only sort of leaves us to say thank you for everybody for joining us. I hope you found it really interesting and very useful. Amanda, thanks very much. Thank you, Jerry, for joining us as usual. Cheers then.